What's up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Trika the Vrendas, and I'd be lying to you if I didn't say this is like the fourth time I record this intro. Halfway through it, I'm always like, let me re-record that. So I'm going to just hopefully get the show out to you today by not doing any more intros. Hopefully this will be the last one. But I just have a few things I wanted to discuss in this intro. One is, if you guys haven't noticed on my YouTube channel, when you're listening to these podcasts, once these intros start, I put right on the screen what minute to fast forward to, so you can fast forward some of these intros. I know that sometimes I go on long rants. I know sometimes these intros are longer than they probably should be. Maybe I'm telling you the same thing over and over again. Every once in a while, you'll get some new news. And the only reason I'm saying this is because YouTube, you know, you get those comments, hey, your intro's a little long, or what's up with the long intro or whatnot. I'm assuming they're not regular listeners, because the regular listeners, if I do ever announce anything new in the intro, they'll hit me up and say, hey, I checked that out. Or, you know, recently the issue with the title of the podcast, people were hitting me up. Tons of listeners hit me up in regards to that. So it was cool to know that people are listening to the intro and they're not a complete waste of my time. But yeah, feel free to fast forward to them on our YouTube channel. Like I said, I will tell you what minute to fast forward to. And so that's the easy way to skip these if you want. I try to make them fast. I try to make them quick. But obviously, I started a podcast because I'm good at talking. And sometimes that leads to long intros. So I've also had a lot of people in the past hit me up in regards to podcasts. Like, hey, do you mind helping me out? How did you do it? Do you have any advice? And I'm always more than happy to be interviewed. I'm more than happy to give you advice, let you know what I do, how I did it, what I would do differently, all those things. So if you ever want to start a podcast, hit me up on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever's more convenient for you, and I'll be more than happy to help you out. But my point in bringing this up is that I think one piece of advice I tell everybody is, don't be so hard on yourself with the first initial podcast episodes, because one, you don't have a whole lot of listeners probably to start off with, which gives you time to kind of improve. And as you get more listeners, hopefully you'll figure out what exactly you're doing or how you want to do it, and you get more comfortable in front of a microphone. But even myself, I mean, I'm over 200 episodes, 6 years in, I still fuck up a lot. I still mess up a lot, and I don't edit it out. I try to, you know, I don't edit out a part that makes me seem like or sound like a dumbass, because we're human. I mean, we're this is honest discussions. It's not live, but I don't edit it kind of like it was a live show, for the purpose of letting you know that, like, hey, this is a real discussion. We're just sharing ideas, sharing thoughts, challenging ideas, challenging thoughts. And sometimes it's not going to always come out perfect. And sometimes you're going to be in the process of gathering your thoughts, and it's not going to be perfect. And also, we're humans. I mean, like myself, I have a full-time job. I have kids. I have hobbies. I get sick. I get tired. And that all affects sometimes my ability to clear my mind and focus on my podcast or focus on the discussion. Sometimes I'm scatterbrained because of other things that are going on outside this show, you know, and which is why the goal one day would be to do this full time, where I could just focus all my time and energy on this show. And I think I'd be able to put out much better shows, because I wouldn't have all my, you know, I wouldn't be spending so much of my energy throughout the day doing other things to pay the bills. So yeah, that's the goal. But anyways, my point is that you get in front of a microphone, and I think you'd realize how much harder it is to sound casual and gather your thoughts compared to doing it when you're just hanging out with your friends and you know you're not being recorded. So it is slightly different, because I think you start maybe analyzing what you're saying or your thoughts a little too much, or at least I do at times, and then I hesitate to share something. I'm sure you guys have heard me at times, like I'm about to say something, but I'm not sure if I'm going to say it correctly, or even if the fact is right. So I kind of hesitate to kind of share what I'm thinking about. So but that's all stuff we work on, and hopefully we get better at. And there's nobody who's harder on me than me. I absolutely get so down on myself when I have a bad episode, or I feel like I could have done better, and I'm really excited when I have a great episode. Hopefully even the bad ones are worth listening to, And when I say bad, I mean the guests are always good. It's just I feel like I could have done a better job maybe bringing something up or I guess connecting with the guest. But like I said, hopefully the guests are always interesting and always worth listening to. So let's talk about my guest today, Lynn Albrecht. Her son doing 2 life sentences for a nonviolent crime, which we get into on this podcast. There's also a great documentary called Deep Web by Alex Winter and narrated by Keanu Reeves, which tells a story of not just Ross, but the website he created called Silk Road, which I'm sure some of you guys have heard about. And this, it's really heart-wrenching. It pulls at your heartstrings because, you know, he's a nonviolent criminal. It's really sad. And I'm glad I'm able to share her story. I actually met her at the Red Pill Expo in Hartford. If any of you guys were listening to the podcast I was doing around that time, I was invited there by Richard Grove from Tragedy and Hope, another great guest I've had on a bunch of times. And he lives not too far from me. So we've got together a few times, hung out, became friends. And super awesome family, awesome guy. And I was down there, and I also had a couple guests on from speakers from the Red Pill Expo. My first guest was Dr. Kendra Becker, which is a great guest about alternative medicine, vaccines, the problem with the healthcare system, so many different interesting topics. And then I also had Richard Gage, who is also a speaker at Red Pill Expo, and he's from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So I had them on right before the Red Pill Expo. Then I got to hang out there, got to meet these people, meet a bunch of other really cool people, and one of the people I met was Lynn. So I was really happy to eventually reconnect with her and get her on the show to share her story. So in the show description, definitely check that out. Recently, I was also on Jason Burmes's YouTube channel. He's a guest who's been on a few times and one of my first guests I ever had on the show. So check out his YouTube channel. Or I just created a playlist called Ricky Verandas Interviews because now I have a couple. So I figured I'd create a playlist. And when I say I have a couple, I literally mean I have 2. I have the one I did with Jason Burmes recently over the weekend, and then also the one that I did on the Tinfoil Hat podcast when I was interviewed in regards to Big Pharma and alternative medicine and all that stuff. So both of those are in my playlist, so check those out. Jason Burmes did a thing called 24 in 24, which was 24 videos in 24 hours right before the change for the terms and services. Today, which is December 10th, I can't talk right now. December 10th, the terms and services for YouTube have changed, and Jason Burmes, myself, and a lot of other people thought that they're going to get kicked off YouTube. So far, so good. We haven't, but he wanted to put out 24 videos, go out with a bang prior to changing the terms and conditions, whatever they're called. So you can see that interview and a bunch of other great interviews he did on his YouTube channel. I think that's it. I think that's about everything. So I'll keep this intro, attempt to keep it under 10 minutes. Oh my God, I suck at this sometimes. But the holidays are around the corner, so I know that money's tight. If you can't support me on Patreon, great. If you do support me, I let you guys know on Patreon who the guests are that I'm booking, guests that I'm attempting to get together for the show, all that stuff. So you kind of know before I release the show who's been on or who I have or who's going to be on and who I'm booking. So just a little perk for helping out. And also remember to share the show, upload it anywhere you want. If by any chance YouTube decides to take down my channel, you know, I'm glad that people are uploading my show in different platforms and different channels and different places. That way, hopefully it still exists somewhere else. This show is going to always exist, hopefully, on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Podcast Addict, which is a great app for podcasts. You know, hopefully it'll always be there. And recently, the only issues or the biggest issue will be YouTube. So I've kind of, you know, it's not a huge platform for me anyways. Most people download and listen to this and subscribe on their cell phones. So it's not a huge deal to me. But people like just Jason Burmes and Sam Tripoli, who have tons of subscribers and tons of videos on YouTube, then, you know, it's a huge blow for them. So hopefully podcasts can still survive on iTunes and Spotify and whatnot completely untouched and unchanged, because it's one of the few places you can still get these casual conversations and really honest discussions. So I'll keep doing that to you. We had a great 2019. Hopefully it won't be the last episode of 2019, but if it is, have a great holiday, have a great end of the year, and hopefully we have a great 2020, and I'll see you guys on the next episode. See ya. Peace.
Okay, yeah, I can hear you fine.
Oh, great. Awesome. Cool. Great. Well, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Happy to be there, wherever I am with you.
I know you, man. Thank you so much. Anytime I get an opportunity to share these type of stories and, you know, just share them with maybe some people who haven't heard these type of stories, I jump on the opportunity. There's, you know, your story definitely hits home.
That's
a
great,
little.
Yeah.
Hits home a little. There's a little bit of an echo. Is that maybe? Do you have me coming out of your speakers by any chance?
Yeah, let me take them out. Okay, how's that? Better?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there we go. No echo.
Okay,
awesome.
Sorry. I'm terrible with the audio. I've got to figure out how to do this better. Okay.
It's all right. I love the opportunity to share these stories. I think when you hear them firsthand from people who are involved, it hits home in a different way. And, you know, I'm a parent, and once I became a parent, my son's 4. So, you know, 4 years ago when I became a parent, when you hear stories about parents dealing with tragedies like, you know, like what you're dealing with and struggles in regards to their children, it hits you a little differently. You know, it hits home a little
Absolutely.
Differently.
Yeah.
You know, I put myself in your position. I think like, what, you know, how would I feel? How would I deal with feeling, you know, dealing with what you're dealing with the fact that you don't have unlimited access to your son. You don't, you know, he's locked up for something unjustified. And it's just, you know, I couldn't even begin to imagine going through that. And I think, you know, any parent listening would probably feel the same way. And I'd love to get into the backstory before we get into all the specifics of the case and what exactly happened, kind of the backstory of who, you know, who are the people involved in your family? Who was Ross? What was your relationship with him? What type of kid was he growing up and that type of stuff? And kind of give a little bit of a background of the person that we're going to be discussing today.
Okay. Well, Ross was a great kid. He was a very easy to raise, a total pleasure. He was very laid back. He still is. Very had lots of friends, played soccer, was a Boy Scout, very artistic and creative, and a really easy child, and remained that way until now. But yeah, he's making up for it now, I guess. But he's still like that, though, really. He's a very laid back guy who's fun, and you know, that's who he is. But he's also very idealistic, and he was very idealistic, became more so in graduate school when he got involved with the Ron Paul campaign, brought Ron Paul to Penn State, began reading Austrian economics and other authors related to that, and became very passionate about free markets and privacy and limited government, and wanted people to have an experience of that. And at first he created a video game about it so people could play the game and kind of experience a free market, and that didn't fly. So he created a website called Silk Road on the internet. And the idea of Silk Road was that it would be a free marketplace for people to exchange what they wanted, as long as it didn't hurt a third party. So two people could exchange pretty much anything as long as nobody else was harmed by it. So because of that, it strictly prohibited child pornography or anything related to pedophilia. It prohibited stolen property, weapons, violent services, etc., because of course those things hurt someone else. And this is in the government's own evidence. This is not debatable. It's right there on the site. So, because it was based on the non-aggression principle of voluntary interaction, and but you know, drugs were allowed. They were considered a choice between two people. Most commonly exchanged were user amounts of cannabis, and so drugs were allowed, and illegal drugs were allowed. And so, because of that and his role in that, he was convicted of conspiracy charges to traffic in narcotics and other things. And he was also charged with and convicted for the kingpin charge, as if he were controlling everything and were like El Chapo or something. And by the way, El Chapo got half the sentence Ross did. So so that's pretty much the background. And now he's in prison. He's serving a double life plus 40-year sentence without the possibility of parole. No charge whatsoever or any history of violence towards anyone, and quite the contrary. And and we're fighting to have this sentence commuted.
Now, growing up, you said he didn't seem really that political until he got it involved with Ron Paul and stuff like that. Were you political? Did you guys talk about personal philosophies and ideologies and stuff like that? Or did everything really, or was it just one of those things where this idea of the libertarian perspective just really captured his interest?
Well, I would say that, you know, my husband and I were entrepreneurs, you know, we still are. And we've always had kind of like, leave us alone and let us live our lives kind of attitude. I did take the libertarian test at one time and came out pretty libertarian in my views. And we talked about things, you know, in our family. We talked about philosophies and different principles. I wouldn't say we were radically political, but, you know, I gave Ross Atlas Shrugged, you know, years ago, and which he devoured. And, you know, things like that. So I guess you could say I started it. But he really became very intense about it in graduate school. He was on his way to getting a PhD in Cornell and dropped it because he said it wasn't his passion anymore, that he really, this was his passion.
Yeah, well, I think the thing about libertarians is you said you took the test. I think most people, if they take the test, they're much more libertarian than they think they are. I think that, you know, the basic principles of just kind of like, you know, you having your right to pursue happiness and letting other people have the right to pursue happiness. And, you know, just kind of, like you said, do your own thing. And just as long as you're not bothering anybody else, then,
right.
You know, why not? Then I think, you know, the basic concept is pretty, it's something that I think most people could accept and jump on board. I remember when Ron Paul was running, I defended him because I was a big fan of his. I mean, Ron Paul's been in politics for a long time. He's been one of the few ones that was consistent with his views. He's one of the few ones that that actually had a ideology and a opinion. And even if you didn't agree with him, at least you knew where he stood. Where most politicians, what would happen is that they tell you one thing and then they would vote against that or go against their own principles because, you know, somebody was giving them money to do so. So it's one of those things where, like, even if you didn't agree with him on everything, one thing that I really liked about Ron Paul was that, like, I know where he stands. Like, if he became president, I know where he would stand on all these issues, and he wouldn't flip-flop. He wouldn't go back on his beliefs. He wouldn't go back on his principles. And that gave me a sense of security and kind of felt like, okay, yeah, I'd feel safe supporting this guy, because once he got my vote, he wouldn't completely backtrack everything that he ran on or all the things he said. I mean, I remember even one of the debates when they were asking him about abortion, and he was obviously anti-abortion, but he's like, as a libertarian, and I'm kind of more or less, this is what he said, because I don't remember his exact words, but he was saying, he's like, but as a libertarian, I wouldn't create a law to ban abortion. He's like, I would just help promote the reasons why I believe abortion is, you know, why I'm against abortion. Maybe put more information out there, you know, whatever it may be. And but so it's one of those things where even if he didn't agree with you, he wasn't trying to stop you from doing something that, you know, that you want to do, even if he didn't think that it was the right thing to do. And the Silk Road was kind of very similar in regards to your son wanted to create a place where people could have the freedom to trade, and it was a free marketplace, completely, you know, unrestricted. And it didn't mean that he had it, he agreed with everything that was being done there or how it was being used, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's true, yeah. No, he doesn't. I mean, he was not accused of selling drugs. He's never been a big drug person at all. And he certainly didn't go into this to be a drug kingpin. That's absurd. He was living in a flat in San Francisco with three roommates. He didn't own a car. He was hardly in it for the big money of a drug kingpin. And there's very few drug kingpins who adhere to the non-aggression principle and voluntary interaction. You know, Ross is an idealist. He believes in freedom, and he thinks people should have choices as long as they're not hurting other people. Doesn't mean he agrees with those choices. You know, people choose a lot of things. And look, I'm not necessarily defending at all everything on Silk Road or, you know, even the site itself, but that was where he was coming from.
I think there is people confuse defending something with just saying people have the right to do it. You know, like I was born in Portugal. It's a country that at one time had, you know, a lot of issues with needles and drugs and they decriminalized it. And it's only completely in all statistics and all the research done afterwards, it's absolutely been a success. And I think
I actually met, just let me say that we met someone from Portugal, and you can maybe corroborate this, that it was getting pretty bad over there and a little bit, you know, sleazy and dangerous, and now it's very safe and wholesome and it all works.
Yeah, well, they look at it as a medical issue instead of a criminal issue, you know, instead of saying, and that's, you know, that's a whole nother conversation. Like, we need to rethink, you know, addiction, and, you know, why are we locking people up if we truly believe they have a substance issue, a substance abuse issue? And, you know, we can go into why they have that substance abuse issue. It could be because of unhappiness, unfulfillment, some trauma they're dealing with, whatever it may be. How is locking them up going to fix that? It doesn't. And so I think that the way they approached it was awesome. And, you know, there is the argument to be made that it's a small country, so it's a small sample size. You know, in a huge country like America, would it work? But you can always make the argument too. The counter argument is, when has making anything illegal ever made it disappear from the face of the earth? I mean, it doesn't.
Prohibition doesn't work, has been proven. It certainly hasn't stopped people from using drugs. The drug war has been going on for over 45 years. It's cost, I think, I don't know how many billions. And they can't even keep drugs out of the prison. So, but it makes a lot of money for a lot of people, and it expands government power. And, you know, so what are we going to do? Keep building prisons and keep caging more people until, we're just totally, you know, a prison state? Because right now, if the prison population were a state, it's bigger than 11 states. So, and over 60% are drug offenders. So the drug war is fueling mass incarceration. And, you know, it's not solving the drug problem at all. Just like prohibition didn't solve alcohol consumption and created the mafia, this prohibition doesn't solve drug use and it's created cartels. So it creates violence. You know, you don't find Absolute and Smirnoff having street wars over who's going to sell their vodka on that block. You know, it's ridiculous. Even Trump himself back in 94 said, well, the way to stop the violence is to legalize. You know, it's just obvious. And then Portugal is a perfect example, like you say. It's a perfect example. And yes, it's a smaller country, but the principle remains the same.
Yeah, and human nature remains the same. I mean, you figure, you know, it again, it just, it seems, it's same thing with the gun issue and a lot of the stuff. It's you make it, the law, if the more laws you put and the more loopholes you create, the people who are going to have to go through those are more hula hoops, I should say, you have to go jump through. The people who have to do all that stuff are law-abiding citizens. I mean, they're the ones who have to deal with all the taxing and all the testing and all the background checking. The criminal is just going to steal it and sell it on the black market. So you creating more laws isn't going to prevent that. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, and you look at, like, the mess that Mexico is at the moment, you know, with drug cartels running a lot of the country. That's a lot of it's because of our drug laws here. I mean, who
totally is. Yeah, totally is. The drug war is destroying Mexico. I was in Acapulco recently for an Acapulco, actually a couple times, and talked to locals. And, you know, they're like, yeah, our tourism is ruined and it's a much more dangerous place. And, you know, it's because of these cartels and the violence of the drug war. If the drug war were over, if drugs were legalized and regulated and all that, it's not like, you know, you'd have children using them, the cartels would be defunded. They wouldn't have any money.
Yeah.
You know, and if they don't have any money, it's, I mean, they may keep a foothold some places like the mafia has, but I mean, they're nothing like they were.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, I mean, they'd probably find some other way of making money, but it, you know, they wouldn't have the, like you said, the strength and finances they have now. And it's just, yeah, I mean, the thing is that it's history repeating itself over and over again. You look at Prohibition, like you said, it created the mob. It, you know, you look at what's going on in Mexico. So it's like, we need to, as hard as it sounds to say that, hey, if you decriminalize these things, that you know, we'd be okay, you know, that there's not going to be an epidemic of people killing themselves by overdose or whatnot. Because the truth is, the majority of us, like, I don't do crack cocaine, or I don't, you know, I don't smoke weed, or I don't do ecstasy, because not because it's illegal, because it's because I just don't want to. Like, it's not something I want to do. It being illegal, like, obviously this stuff is still, the ability of getting it is still there. So if I wanted to try this stuff, or try cocaine, or try ecstasy, I could. I could find somebody who could get it. I could have you know, a friend who knows somebody who could get it for me, or whatever it may be. And I could give it a try if I want to. Or I could be at a party where somebody had it and I could give it a try. But I don't do it because it's not something I want to do. So to think that the reason why people aren't doing it is because of these laws, and it's not because of maybe their judgment, their personal opinions or philosophies on doing these substances, is just silly. You know, it's not what stops people from doing it. So I think, you know, we need to rethink a lot of this stuff. And, you know, this goes back to kind of the libertarian, you know, philosophy, because it's personally, I don't use the label libertarian, but a lot of times when I'm having discussions about stuff, I find myself, you know, my views parallel a libertarian views, because, you know, I think that it's hard to argue that, you know, people should have the right to do what they want as long as they're not harming anybody else. And they also pick and choose, you know, what they want to make illegal and not anyways. I can go buy a handle. I mean, personally, I'm an alcohol drinker. I like my bourbon. I like my wine. But I can go buy enough whiskey to kill myself completely legally, and that's not a problem. But yet, you know, you look at how long it took even for medical marijuana to you know, to become a part of American culture, and it just it there's no consistency with their views. It's all like, okay, we want to tax this, or we want to make this illegal, but it's not based on how many people it's killing, or that these laws are actually protecting people or preventing people from using these things. It's just, you know, it's based on, like, what? I mean, like, these flawed logics.
Well, you have to see who benefits, you know, quid bono. And obviously, nobody is stopping using drugs because of this, but many, many people are making a lot of money. I've been told by law enforcement people it's an intricate, intrinsic part of our economy at this point. And that you know, that you can just, all you have to do is look at the top five lobbyists against marijuana legalization, and you can see it's true. Private prisons.
Yep.
Prison guard unions, that takes care of the public prisons. And really they're meshed as far as I'm concerned. They're both making tons of money, and people in them are. Police unions, it's a jobs program for prison guards, police, these people. Alcohol and drug companies, and the pharmaceuticals, of course. They're all actively lobbying against marijuana legalization, and you could throw in the cartels who aren't an open lobby, but you better believe they're a lobby. And all of these people have a vested interest in keeping this drug war going. They could care less about whether people are doing drugs, in my opinion. They couldn't care less.
Oh yeah, you see it all the time. I mean, people, based on how good of an attorney you have or who you know, who you're friends with, you get off on things. And then if you don't know anybody and you don't have money, they treat you like you're a criminal, like you're some, you know, but it is. I mean, the whole system's flawed. I mean, how many people get, you know, they get tricked into saying they did something they didn't do? How many people get, you know, you scare the shit out of somebody. I mean, you tell them, hey, if you don't take this plea deal, you could spend the rest of your life in prison. Yeah, I'm going to admit that I did something I didn't do just because I'm picking the least of two crappy options, you know. So it's, you know, the whole system is just completely flawed. One of my best friends is a police officer, and he has said numerous of times, he's like, I'd rather let somebody go, you know, because I don't have enough on them who I might be iffy if they're actually guilty or not. And then lock somebody up who's innocent. And
that's good to hear.
Yeah. And the reason he says that. Yeah. And his logic makes sense, because he's like, because the criminal, if we don't get him for this thing, if he actually is a bad person, he'll eventually do it again or do something else and he'll get locked up. So we'll get him eventually, you know, but it's not fair to put somebody in prison who's innocent. And, you know, to go back to your son, I mean, well, Silk Road, for people who...
Well, let me just say something about that.
Please, yeah.
Because 98% of people plea now, even to things they... And I know personally know people who have pled to things that they did not do because they're bullied and threatened by prosecutors, or families are threatened. If they go to trial, they're going to lose, which is true, and that's what happened with Ross. He got a much worse sentence than he would have, and I believe... And typically that's true. You pay a trial penalty. And prosecutors in general, from what I've understand and what I've observed, do not care if someone's innocent or guilty at all. Now, I think you have a nice friend. He's got some principles. But not everybody in the system is like that. And yes, it's a very corrupt and really evil system now. Our principles that this country was really founded on are being hijacked, and a great deal of that's happening in the criminal justice system. That, you know, people should have a right to a trial, a fair trial. That is a foundational principle of our country, and that is not that is not available anymore.
Yeah, I mean, perfect example. I do know a lot of local police officers, and you know, there's been times I've gotten a speeding ticket. But knock on wood, I haven't used many favors throughout my life, and you know, maybe two times I think I've gotten a speeding ticket that I've asked for somebody to get me out of it. Not so much because I don't mind paying the speeding ticket. It's more the insurance premium that goes up for 1,000 years that I really don't want to pay. And you know, you go to court, and what ends up happening in one case is that they the judge says that he lost your paperwork or whatever, and then it just gets dismissed, and that's it. But I'll be waiting there, and I'll see other people going before me, and people who are probably speeding less than I was or whatnot, and they'll be talking to them like they're these criminals, and that, oh yeah, you should know better, and blah blah blah. But just because I know somebody, you know, and I shouldn't even be saying this because, you know, I guess maybe they're not going to help me when one of them hear that I'm saying this. But my point is, I'm just showing, it's an example of how, like, that person who has to pay the ticket or pay the fine is no less innocent than I am. The only difference is I know somebody. So I get cut some slack, and he ends up having to pay a fine, and his insurance premium goes up for you know, a certain amount of years. So it's like, it's not about who's right or wrong, or trying to create a system where it's like, oh yeah, we penalize those who are guilty and we let go those who aren't. It's like, no, it's who you know, and you see it all the time with you hire the right lawyer who's maybe, you know, played golf with the judge or know somebody or whatnot, and then you get off on things. You know, I know people who've had multiple DUIs and still have their license, and I know people who, you know, get one DUI and lose their license for a long period of time. So it's just like, it really is, how much are you willing to spend, and who do you know? And when your system is controlled by those ingredients, then obviously it's not going to be the just and fair system that we like to pretend we have. And, you know, a very similar story that reminds me of your son's story is the Aaron Schwartz story. Yeah. You know, another, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with his story.
Yes, I've met his brother.
Oh, wow.
Terrible, horrible story.
Well, for my listeners who maybe aren't familiar with his story, could you share just kind of a brief outline of what happened to him and the similarities to your son?
Well, he was persecuted by prosecutors for making material available on the internet, and you know, Ross, I believe, was persecuted by prosecutors too, and I think it was probably a political motivation. And you know, in Aaron Schwartz's case, tragically, he killed himself in prison. And actually, this is a very way too common that people do commit suicide in prison. Ross personally knows two people from the last prison he was in who committed suicide. And one reason I have moved, not that I think Ross is suicidal, but I have moved three times to be near him to make sure he has a lifeline to the outside world and encouragement and not feel like he's forgotten, because I don't want him to get to the place where he feels so distraught. And I'm not saying Aaron Schwartz's parents weren't there for him. I know they were in his case. But I don't know why or what was behind it. But yes. And then the prosecutor didn't even express any sympathy. I mean, I just remember that reading that. It was just awful.
Yeah. I mean, he basically he got in trouble for releasing, what was it, like Harvard?
MIT, I believe.
MIT, yeah. A bunch of MIT research or books or something along those lines. It's been a long time.
MIT didn't even want to press charges, I don't think, after a while. It was just the prosecution. But see, they get a notch in their belt. They get it's a stepping stone in their career. And that's how they see it. They're very ambitious people, from what I gather and from what I've heard.
Yeah, there's a great documentary about him. I think it's called like The Internet's Own Boy or something like that.
Yes, it is. That's correct.
Yeah, so if people want to learn more about his story, please check that out. There's also a documentary on your son's story. Well, I think is a little popular is came out in 2015 by Alex Winter called.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's about the only good one I know about, but there may be others, but a lot of them are. Well, I don't watch a lot of them because it's upsetting to see lies about being told, but I've been told about them enough that they're not accurate. They're not telling the truth. And so people, you know what? You can't believe the media for the most part, and you can't believe documentaries or books or any, it's like you have to really look into things because you just can't believe it. I've run into so many lies with this whole thing that I'm just extremely skeptical.
Yeah,
but Deep Web is very good. Deep Web is a good documentary. It doesn't try to answer all the questions, but it brings up a lot of interesting insights into the whole thing, and not just about Ross, but about the dark net and all of that and the people involved. So, yeah, I'd recommend Deep Web.
Yeah, because, I mean, the dark net, I mean, they say that, you know, you use Google and you have access to like 5% of the internet. There's all this other crazy stuff out there. Yeah, it's actually narrated by Keanu Reeves. I believe you can rent it on Amazon Prime and some other places. So mm-hmm. Definitely check that out. It goes deep into the story and goes into Silk Road. I mean, so one of the other reasons why, because similar to Aaron Schwartz, it does seem like, you know, this was motivated much more than just specifically what he was doing. It seems like you know, they were, because I've heard even Alex Winter in interviews saying that he was kind of surprised by, he thought that he was going to, you know, a lot of these people in this world were just going to be kind of like computer nerds. And, but he's like, these people had philosophies. They were political, you know, they were, very political. And I think one of the reasons, you know, well, he was using Bitcoin, right? On Silk Road, you had to use Bitcoin, I believe, which helped, you know.
Yes, you did. It was the first proof of use of Bitcoin. Bitcoin wasn't really even known or proven to be able to be used as money until then, which is one reason so many people in the Bitcoin and blockchain world support Ross so much.
Yeah,
because they know that they wouldn't, many of them would not have the wealth they have if it weren't for Ross. That and that he made it possible with his vision of using Bitcoin. That's correct. And it was because he saw the potential for monetary freedom with Bitcoin. I mean, that's what, again, Ross was motivated by idealism, by wanting to bring freedom to people. That's what his motivation was. Now, you can argue that it was a reckless idea, that he was young. He was 26 years old. You know, he was maybe, you know, I certainly don't recommend people doing this, obviously. But his intentions were good. They were not evil. And someone who's a first-time offender, nonviolent, to be given, well, to have to spend the rest of his life, the rest of his life. He's already in his mid-30s now. He was 26 in prison, in a cage, for something they did when they were 26 is not right. It is actually a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, which is against cruel and unusual punishment. And it is a cruel and very unusual punishment for what Ross did.
Yeah, I believe he's 35, right? I'm 34.
Yeah. So yeah, he's 35.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's born in 84. I was born in 85. So it's like, yeah, I mean, he's my age. And that's what boggles my mind, is that, you know, I feel like I still have so much of my life ahead of me. And this guy, your son, you know, is looking, you know, he doesn't know, you know, and.
And you've been able to, you have a child, you're married, I assume. You have a family.
Yep.
Ross would like that. Ross wants that.
Yeah,
I would like to have a grandchild. And, you know, he's being deprived. Our family's being deprived of him. And so, because it's not only the person who's in jail or prison who suffers, it's their family.
Of course.
Yeah. We're all doing time. And I understand incarcerating people who are an actual danger. Ross is not a danger to anyone at all. Like I said, quite the contrary. He's been charitable and compassionate all his life. And there's 100 letters on our website talking about his character, how he's contributed to them. These are people who actually know him, not people, you know, these are actual friends and family and associates. And when you read those letters, you go, no, this isn't right. And that's why I really please, people sign our petition. It's at freeross.org/petition. All you have to agree with is that it's wrong to have a nonviolent person given a double life sentence. It's crazy. I would sign a petition for any nonviolent person not to have a double life sentence, anyone. In fact, I would go a step further and say, I don't even see why they're in prison. We can figure out something better. But in any case, please go and sign the petition. I want to be able to go to President Trump and say, this is important. I want to say this many people, which right now we're approaching 250,000, believe you should pay attention to this and correct this terrible wrong that's been done.
Yeah, it you know, for people who don't know, he has double life with no possibility of parole, right?
Yeah, plus 40 years. Don't forget the little 40 years that judge tacked on there.
And so this judge, there's also some, this judge, what, I mean, did it, because I know that the judge spoke a few times about his he just didn't agree, it seemed like he didn't agree with Ross's ideology. And, but it boggles my mind that because the judge seemed to disagree with, I guess, Ross's philosophies and maybe the way he looked at the world, that they would be harder on him. But it seems like that's the case, right?
Well, yeah, it was a woman, Catherine Forrest, and she says it at sentencing. She said, it is notable that you started the site for philosophical reasons, and I'm just not sure that's a philosophy you've left behind. Well, this philosophy she's talking about is a libertarian, voluntary non-aggression principle philosophy. And apparently she found this so threatening and dangerous that she felt she had to put Ross in a cage for the rest of his life. And this, of course, is a complete violation of the First Amendment. We're not supposed to be caged for life or at all for our philosophy or our political beliefs. We're supposed to be able to have any political belief or philosophy we want in this country. That's part of freedom of speech and thought. And yes, you're correct. She used that. She said it. It's in writing. It's in the record. She said it. I have to take her at her word that that is one of the things that influenced her was his philosophy.
Yeah, and then the other thing too is that I think it was Edward Snowden who provided papers to The Intercept about NSA infiltrating Bitcoin users. You think that was an influence in this?
Yeah, and that just corroborated what I had already thought, which was that this is not a drug case. That's obvious because the biggest drug seller, who's convicted of being the biggest drug seller on Silk Road, got 10 years. He is the same offense level as Ross. Why does he get 10 years and Ross has to die in prison? I think it is the Bitcoin. And it came out in Snowden papers revealed that the NSA was urgently tracking Bitcoin users a few months before Silk Road was brought down, which makes it obvious that the NSA was part of this whole thing. And of course that's illegal, but they were, it's obvious, you know? And I think it was the concept of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and alternative currencies was very threatening to the financial powers. And I think that's why they went after him so hard. And that's why they, made an example of him to try to stop other people from doing it. It's been a big failure. It hasn't stopped anybody from doing anything, but that's what they were attempting to do, I guess, you know, and have a notch in their belt and a trophy. I mean, the prosecutors all benefited from it. And that's how it works.
Yeah. And then there's also a link with Chuck Schumer and the judge, right? And he obviously has some links to banking and whatnot.
Yeah, he recommended her for her position on the bench. And Preet Bharara, who Trump fired, was the lead prosecutor, and he was Schumer's special counsel for years. He's his cohort, and he was the lead prosecutor. Ross was brought to New York from California. He had no connection to New York at all. He lived in California and was arrested in California, but he wasn't tried or sentenced in California. He was brought to New York. So, you tell me.
where is he located now, or is that something you don't want to make public?
No, it's fine. It's public. You can go to the Bureau of Prisons and see where all these people are. He's in Tucson. He's at a maximum security prison in Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah. The other thing people don't really put in perspective, and because knock on wood, hopefully nobody listening has to ever go to prison, but you take somebody who's nonviolent, who, a likable, nice kid, my age, 34, 35, and you put them around people who are in prison for violent offenses, drug dealing, murder, whatever it may be. And unfortunately, in some cases, you make these nonviolent people that you put in prison a little bit violent to survive, for survival purposes. And you surround them with, you put them in a place where to survive, you have to do things you might not morally be for or whatnot. Or if that doesn't happen, there's also issues with trauma. I mean, what type of trauma does he have to deal with living in that environment, where you do see people getting the crap beat out of them, people who have serious issues or whatnot. You visiting him and you staying in contact with him, how has he done dealing with being in prison and all the things that come with that?
Well, first of all, you're right. They call it a correctional institute, which is the biggest joke. It is a criminal training ground. You're right. You learn how to be a criminal to survive in there. It's a whole other world. It's a whole other society. And, initially, Ross was thrown into one of the most violent prisons in the country with violent gangs and you know, dangerous prisoners because of his life sentence. His security score, which measures someone's dangerousness, was so low he would have been in a camp. But because of the sentence this judge gave him, he was thrown into this environment, and there were suicides, there were stabbings, there were murders, there were beatings. It was a very intense and violent place. Ross refused to participate in an assault on another inmate, and because of that, he was put himself in danger, because if you say no, you then suddenly you're the one that's going to get beaten up. And he put himself in protective custody, which meant sitting in an 8x10 metal box with no window for 3.5 months. And now he's been moved to Tucson, thankfully, because that is where they put people who are in danger in the normal prisons. And those people are escaping violence. They're not violent themselves. So, so he's in a much better place now, but he survived that other place for a year and a half. And, you know, he's gone through a little post-traumatic stress. I mean, it's just very, you know, you have to be always on the alert constantly in a place like that. So it's tough, very hard, especially for someone like Ross, who's, you know, civilized, a nonviolent guy, you know.
And have you noticed a difference in his personality or, you know, just being around this, you know, this type of atmosphere? Has it got to him? Because I know people who've worked at prisons, and just working there has changed, you know, who they are. You know, they become more violent, or they become more judgmental, stuff like that. Have you noticed anything different with his personality, or, you know, your interactions with him?
Well, I would say Ross's personality is still Ross. And that's one of the reasons I'm committed to being where he is, so that he doesn't only associate with that world. And he has, again, that lifeline. He has interaction with, you know, his family and his loved ones that keep him centered. I would say he's matured. He certainly learned a whole hell of a lot that he never would have known. But that would have happened, you know, just becoming 35. I'm sure you're more mature now than you were at 26. I mean, life does mature you. But as far as his, you know, personality and who he is, I would say, no, he's still Ross. We have a good time. Still has a great sense of humor. He's smart. He's, you know, easygoing still, like I was telling you. He wrote a essay called 5 Keys to Inner Strength I Learned in 5 Years in Prison. It's on our website as well as on Medium. And it's a very inspiring essay. It's actually helped me a lot too. And Ross consciously and intentionally applies himself to being positive and to rising above a lot of that negative stuff. Very challenging, and I'm proud of him for it. And so I would say, bottom line, no, his personality and essentially who he is the same, but he's a more mature person and also a much more worldly wise person than he was when he went in.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear, because there is, you know, the danger of being around that type of atmosphere having some psychological negative effect on
sure.
you.
And well, that's, again, why I have moved 3 times across the country, gave up a lot to be around him, yeah. because I felt like I wasn't willing to lose him to that.
Well, it sounds like he's not just tech savvy. He's also very emotional and mentally stable and intelligent to be able to handle.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, it really does take some mental strength to still see the positiveness in all this, and just in regards to that, you know, are you guys hopeful that do you have any updates, any recent updates, any you know, anything that any positive news that, you know, in regards to his case and possibly getting him out?
Well, you know, it's a very steep climb. We do have a lot of really great, amazing people who have stood by us and walked beside us through this whole thing, and also who are joining us now. There's a widespread support page on our website with some very impressive people who have spoken out publicly against this sentence and for Ross. So that's always encouraging when you have, I mean, actually, Jim Cantrell, I don't know if you know who he is, but he is a very eminent man. He and I met, and he's come out publicly on Facebook just yesterday. I'm going to do whatever I can do to get him free, you know, and others, you know. And so that's very encouraging, gives us hope. The main thing, all it is honestly, it's people and paperwork. All it takes is a signature on a piece of paper, Trump's signature, to have Ross walk out those doors and start being a constructive member of our community again. And, you know, it's not like an impossibility at all. It's quite possible. So we do keep our hopes up. Doesn't mean we don't get discouraged and despairing, but if you don't hope, and as Ross says, as long as there's life, there's hope. He's alive. You know, he's still alive. And as long as he's still alive, we will keep fighting to have him out of there.
Yeah, and people have to, they have to see what, you know, look at Chelsea Manning, look at, you know, Julian Assange, look at so many different people, how, you know, Aaron Swartz, how, you know, how they treat these people. I mean, obviously Edward Snowden can't even, he's afraid of even coming to the country. You know, so people have to speak up, people have to speak out, people have to talk about this stuff. I mean, I know Keanu Reeves is a narrator of Deep Web. It'd be great if he was motivated to say something. I mean, because unfortunately,
well, he has a statement. He has a statement on our page.
Oh, he does. Oh, great. Awesome. Yeah, because that does go a long way. You know, just celebrities, they do have far reach. And I know the Memphis, what was it, the Memphis Five or Memphis Three in the 90s, you know, Pearl Jam and a lot of artists came out and spoke out about that case, and it was a huge help in getting those kids, well, went to jail as kids and came out adults, end up getting out, and that was a huge help. So yeah, I mean, I think sometimes the simple thing of like spreading, well, not to use the name of the podcast, but to start a little ripple effect and just spreading these stories, sharing them, you know, talking to people about it, maybe text messaging a friend to petition and saying, hey, you know, it just takes 2 seconds to sign this, sign it. You know, I know, well, Donald Trump, a friend of his, Roger Stone, is a libertarian. Maybe you know, some other libertarians that are close to him can be motivated to possibly help out, because what he was doing, I mean, it's crazy, because he is just as responsible for you know what was going on the website as, you know, anybody who works at Amazon would be if I illegally sent something or sold something on Amazon. You know, it's just like it doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't. You know, so, and I think it brings up another really important topic about privacy, and that we should have some privacy. I mean, if I went to somebody's mailbox and made photocopies of all their mail before they opened it, they'd be pissed. But if Amazon or Google or the NSA is basically doing the same thing with our information online, we accept it. So I think that, you know, for some reason we look at internet privacy completely different than we have in the past.
Right. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But thank you so much, Lynn. Is there anything else you want to add to the story you think is important that maybe we didn't hit on?
You know, I went into this having faith in our justice system, having faith in our country, and I'm now see that we do not have fair trials. The system is corrupt. There are multiple thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are being caged that shouldn't be. I think that this is just a symptom of the fact that we are losing our freedoms very quickly. And I think we're at a tipping point in history. I think, you know, it's we're at a crossroads. And either we're going to go towards more innovation and creativity and freedom, or we're going to go towards more surveillance of the government on individuals, control and restriction. And it's up to us, you know. And this whole thing with Ross has brought this home to me. And really, by supporting Ross's freedom, it will be a pushback to this kind of government overreach that really needs to be challenged. It's getting really out of hand, in my opinion. And so I just encourage people, please sign the petition, freeross.org/petition. Please, if you have any political contacts, please get a hold of me. There's a footer on every page of our website, freeross.org. You can contact me. We are also organizing people to show up at Trump's rallies around the country with showing support for Ross. We've had successful ones now in New Hampshire, Dallas, and yesterday, Florida. If anybody would like to help with that effort, either in their own state or overall, please contact me. And, you know, there's ways on the website to help, and there's ways to donate, because this is very expensive. It's one of the ways the government crushes people, is to be so expensive that you can't fight them. So any of these things, please spread the word, you know. And it's not just for Ross. It's we need change.
Yeah, that's the thing about these stories, is that even though I love sharing the personal aspect of it, I think people have to be reminded that this isn't just about, you know, your personal story and Ross's personal story, but we need to fight back so this doesn't happen again, because there are other stories like this, and it's easy for me to be in the outside.
Oh, yeah. He's not the only one. Oh, absolutely. No, no. There's over 17,000 nonviolent people serving life in our prison. It's outrageous.
Yeah. And and that's the thing. Like, it's easy when I'm not in trouble to say, like, oh, whatever, I'll just go on my everyday life and not care about, you know, the story. But it doesn't take much for you to be, you know, stuck in the system, or you to be, you know, locked up. And it just, there's that book. What was it, like, 3 crimes a day or something like that? How,
you know, 3 felonies a day. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and how people, there's so many ridiculous laws and rules that really all you have to do is get on the bad side of the system, and they can just use all that shit against you. You know, you look at all the whistleblowers, you know, Thomas Drake, who's been on my show, John Kiriakou, so many people who have been, you know, they've done time for exposing people who should be doing, you know, who should be locked up, you know. So it's just, it's wild. The system is broken, it's corrupt, and, you know, if we can help one person at a time, it goes a long way, because...
Right, it sets precedent for the other people.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, right.
Well, thanks a lot, Lynn. I'm going to put links, once the show's up and live, I'll send you the links, and I'll put links to your website, your Twitter account, and all your social media sites in the show notes, and hopefully people listening to this will take the 2 seconds to... you know, to sign the petition, and you know, even if that's all they do, you know, at least do that, do something. And just coming from somebody who started this podcast because I felt like I needed to do something to contribute, I think, you know, when opportunities come about where you can do something to contribute like this, do it, because you do feel better. It does make you feel like you're helping. And we can all, if we all pitch in, then we can all do something. And that small change can hopefully turn into a much bigger change. So so thanks a lot, Lynn. I really appreciate it. Have a great rest of the week and Thanksgiving. And hopefully we speak again. We actually ran into each other. We met at the Red Pill Expo.
Right.
Now seems like forever ago, but
it sure does.
that was a great event, and just it was awesome. Well, and it was close to home because I'm from Massachusetts, so it was you know, it was easy to get there and whatnot. Do you go to a lot of those? Do you you travel to go to a lot of those conferences?
I've been to a lot of conferences. I didn't speak at that one. I had a table, but normally I do speak, and I'm. Yeah, I do. I'm kind of cutting back because, I'm exhausted, but seriously, but yeah, I've met so many of the people who helped me now and raised a lot of money and all of that by personally going to these conferences. And, so yeah, I do.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there too. Actually I was invited by Richard Grove, which is, I know somebody who you've, had many hours of discussions with. So if anybody wants to check out,
they're friends, good friends. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Richard's awesome. Yeah. I've been to his house, great family, great person. And, you know, he has a, for people who are listening, he's been on the show a bunch of times, but people who aren't familiar with him, it's Tragedy and Hope. Check out his website and check out his work, and check out Lynn's conversations with him. They have some great interviews there too, where you go deep into you know, what's going on in your life, and also this the story of your son. So definitely check that
out.
But yeah, thank you, Lynn. I really appreciate it. Enjoyed it. Yeah, yeah, and hopefully we reconnect in the near future with some good news.
I hope so too.
Thanks
so much for having me.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
I believe in the ripple effect.